Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Sunny Koo, who's the senior lecturer in ethnomusicology at the University of Auckland. And she'll be talking about her new book, Sound of the Border, Music and Identity of Korean Minority in China, which was published in 2021 by University of Hawaii Press. For people living in borderlands between assertive, centralizing states, questions of identity and belonging are often acute, with borderlanders sometimes feeling forced to choose one side or the other of an international divide. Yet Koreans in China, or Joseonjok in Korean, Chaoshenzu in Chinese, have, for much of recent history, been very adept in navigating the shifting demands of being both Chinese and Korean. This is evident, as I know from my own fieldwork, in everything from the language, food, political outlooks, architecture, and tradition one encounters in Yanbian, the autonomous region in northeast China, where Chinese Koreans mostly live today. Sunny Koo's new book, however, makes a strong case for music being one of the richest reflections of this community's complex cultural world and the kinds of creative expression which have emerged from it over the past century and a half. Charting the entangled histories of the Korean presence in China and the music performed and consumed by the community, Koo offers an in-depth account of the shifting styles, genres, and themes present in Chaoshenzu musical output over time, from Korean folk songs and traditional instrumentation to Chinese and North Korean-influenced socialist propaganda songs, up to a commercialized blend of essentialized ethnic music influenced by South Korean pop more recently. Woven in with this are numerous reflections on the shifting social and political contexts inhabited by Chaoshenzu musicians and their publics, helping us to understand wider questions of identity, creativity, and history relevant well beyond Northeast Asia. Sound of the Border shows that from all the complexity of Chaoshenzu experience, there emerges not so much a confused cacophony as a highly distinctive musical tradition, which reflects the unique expressive space occupied by people navigating, overlapping, and intersecting cultural worlds. But in any case, the author is here herself to help us navigate through these layers and influences. So I'll say, Sunny Koo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ed. What a wonderful introduction to my book. Thank you very much.
Well, it's only a small hint at what lies between the book's covers, but we'll be delving into all of that, of course, ourselves in more detail as the interview progresses. But before we get there, perhaps you could start with a bit of an introduction, helping us understand how you became interested in the topic of this book and your kind of broader academic background.
Yeah, I was born and raised in South Korea until I moved to the U.S. As an international student with intention to study Western classical music as a violin player. However, soon after I began my undergraduate studies in music, I decided that I rather major in music history and theory than pursuing a performance major. So in NYU, I completed my BA and MA in music with a focus on Western classical music analysis. And for my PhD, I moved to Hawaii and studied ethnomusicology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And since 2011, I'm living in Auckland, New Zealand, and teaching ethnomusicology, which is embraced in anthropology department in University of Auckland.
I see, I see. And in terms of, I mean, maybe this is not something you're able to answer, but in terms of coming to ethnomusicology from a background in music, in, you know, in performance and in actual musical practice, is that more common than coming to ethnomusicology from, say, an anthropology background? Or is it the other way around? I don't know. Are there many ethnomusicologists who sort of start from the music side rather than the anthropology side? What do you think about that? Do you have any sense?
Well, it is actually both. Ethnomusicology is a discipline that is grounded in musical as well as anthropological studies. So we study music as a human expression and social manifestation. We investigate music in cultural contexts by conducting field research and paying great attention to social and cultural significances. But many of ethnomusicologists come with musical background, and often ethnomusicologists are musicians themselves. So we also learn to study music in a cultural context.
Great, great. Well, yeah, certainly a lot of that close sensitivity to music itself, not just the social or political or cultural context, which, you know, I think maybe would be more familiar to many anthropologists. It really comes through in the book. So I'm looking forward to talking about that. But how about the project itself for Sound of the Border, the book? How did that come about?
Well, it was about, now it's almost 20 years ago, when I was taking a break from my graduate studies and living in Seoul. Around 1999 and 2000, it was completely by chance, I met a Cho Sing-ju composer who was studying his PhD in a renowned South Korean university. And I got into conversation with him, and he explained that Cho Sing-ju construction of music is quite different from what we know as Korean music practiced in South Korea. However, at the time, music of Cho Sing-ju was not available for me to listen to outside of China. So I had a great curiosity what the music that the composer was explaining and describing, but then there was no way for me to actually sonically experience this music. So that was my sort of first inspiration and drive for to learn and find more about Cho Sing-ju music. Mm-hmm. And also, back in 1999, I already encountered quite a number of Cho Sing-ju who are working in a range of different sectors in Korea. But I found out that, you know, very little information that I had about these fellows who came from China. So that was another inspiration and motivation for me to explore about Cho Sing-ju culture, Cho Sing-ju people, and Cho Sing-ju music.
Right, right. And was the book something that then grew out of a broader research project for your PhD?
Yes. So I was always interested in migration and identity because I myself was a migrant who lived in North America some time. So the identity issue was quite intriguing for me. And also, I was brought up as a classical violinist, having no, not much information about what other musics available, and not even Korean music was something that I could, explain to people with confidence. So there are tons of music that I don't know, and there is a fellow Koreans who I don't know. So these are some of the motivations that I want to focus on Cho Sing-ju and Cho Sing-ju community as my doctoral study project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's I think a really good kind of set of motivations for us to understand how the project came about. So I think we can jump into some of the kind of content and what I guess was eventually produced as this excellent book. So you've kind of given us a sense already of how you first encountered the idea of Cho Sing-ju music and what your kind of first hints of it were from being in Seoul in South Korea. But how did you kind of get more into it? How did you become more in sort of involved in hearing Chao Shenzhou music, and how did you get sort of more experience of it in order to do the research?
Right. I mean, I visited Yanbian as I wanted to explore the topic for my larger PhD project. And there I met a couple of musicians and scholars who were introducing me to the Chao Shenzhou music. Even if so, the identity of Chao Shenzhou music was not so clear to me until I met a lot of people as I conduct my PhD research in Yanbian. So I would say that I came to Yanbian and I start studying Chao Shenzhou music with quite without much information and without much sound experience with Chao Shenzhou music. As I meet a lot of people and hearing about their discourses of Chao Shenzhou music, as I learn to play Chao Shenzhou instrument, I gradually began to understand what Chao Shenzhou music is. And even now, I'm not fully sure that I completely understand what Chao Shenzhou music is and what their identities are. I try my best to share what I experienced in the Yanbian and what I heard from my informants as much as I can. So that was kind of a background of me going to Yanbian and start studying Chao Shenzhou music.
Right. Well, that feeling of having completed a research project, supposedly completed a research project, but still not being able to fully explain what it is about is something I think many people, well, including me, are very familiar with. So I think that feels like a normal kind of situation to have delved into a topic very deeply and still be quite unsure of whether you've actually fully understood what's going on. But in this case, you know, there's an awful lot of good reason for that too, because you're dealing with such a wide variety of different influences and a complex borderland and a history of migration mm-hmm. that is itself very complex. So I wonder if actually leading on from that, could you give us a bit more of a picture of the Chao Shenzhou community in China and sort of background about how it formed and you know, basically how Koreans ended up in this part of northeast China, we should say. Yanbian is, you know, in Jilin province in northeast China. So can you give us some of the history of that community? And then in turn, you know, to expand why music is a particularly interesting way of investigating this history mm-hmm. or identity.
Right. So Chao Shenzhou refers to the Korean minority in China. Between the second half of 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, about 2 million Koreans migrated to China in search of economic opportunity and political stability. So settling primarily in Chinese northeastern region, then now known as Yanbian Korean Autonomous Prefecture, which borders to today's North Korea, these Koreans developed a distinctive cultural identity as one of the 55 Chinese ethnic minorities, closely interacting with North Korea throughout the 1990s and with South Korea since the establishment of diplomatic relations between China and South Korea in 1992. At the early stage of migration, many of them were farmers and not having much time or resources for developing their own cultural identity or their own musical cultures. Their music throughout the first half of the 20th century was attributed mostly with folk songs, farmers' band music, and a farmers' wind instrument called the tungso and blown bamboo flute. When they were designated as a Chinese ethnic minority in 1949 or around that time, they started expanding their music cultures by developing ethnic instrumental music traditions and training musicians who specialized in Korean instruments. And one of the motivations for them to expand and develop their musical traditions were they want to make their instrumental tradition comparable to those of other minorities in China, as well as Han Chinese majority. Mm-hmm. For this community, the development of Korean music reflects the social transformation and shaping of a Korean community as a Joseonju minority, a Chinese minority group. So I view music as a cultural and social construction, and it is a very instrumental to investigate identity because it communicates with people at personal level, and also it often marks collective identity as a representation of a nation or ethnic culture. So that is why I focused on music, and I use music as a way to investigate and discuss Joseonju identity and cultural construction.
Great. Well, yeah, I think you demonstrate very clearly that it's an excellent lens into this the complex history and the many different sort of influences and negotiations that are part of that evolving Joseonju identity over time. But I guess following on from that, as you became more involved in your research and you spent time in Yeonbian and you kind of heard more Joseonju music and spoke to more Joseonju musicians and were generally more involved in the scene, I guess. What were kind of some of the questions that you subsequently found it most interesting to ask? Because I guess, you know, any kind of field work often starts out with some questions you might have at the beginning, but then when you actually do the field work, lots of new questions emerge. So what kind of questions were most important to you in investigating this question of the interplay between music and identity?
Yeah, actually, there is one central question I always return to, and I always carried on throughout my research. The question was, what makes Joseonju music so distinctive? What makes the Joseonju firmly assert that their music is different from that of Koreans in North Korea and South Korea? Okay. And this wasn't so clear to me at the beginning, and it only became clear and made sense as I met so many Joseonju musicians and analyzing music, reading about Joseonju music, and also visiting multiple times Yeonbian and try to find out this music, how it is similar or how it is different from that of North Korea and South Korea. So it was a kind of simple question that I start with, but something that I had to carry on until the end of my research. So a lot of Joseonju musicians were talking that, you know, their music is a distinctive because it was influenced by Chinese culture and because it is a music that created by Joseonju musicians and cultural intellectuals. But there are quite a bit of gray area that, you know, whether is this only the case of Joseonju or is this also similar to what was constructed as a national music in North Korea? I mean, to me, yes, if you are comparing South Korea's traditional music as a conservative and more maintaining the sort of ancient, you know, older tradition of, you know, South Korean culture, or Korean culture, then maybe Joseonju music can be contrasted with that of South Korea. However, many Joseonju musicians also describe their music as a, you know, something that combines a tradition and progressiveness that you will find both South Korea and North Korea. So finding out what is then the characteristic that I can, you know, say about Joseonju music in one sentence. I mean, that was my major quest all the way through the end of my, you know, PhD research as well as finishing my book.
Well, I think that is a very recognizable kind of question or issue in any borderland situation or any situation with multiple sort of cultural worlds involved, because it's difficult. You don't want to describe people only in comparison with other people that they might be like or different from, right? There's some desire to say something declarative and assertive and positive, sort of descriptive about the people for themselves, rather than just saying, oh, well, it's not this, it's not this. I think that applies really to any kind of, I guess, broader cultural-based or social-based research. So I think that that makes a lot of sense. But I mean, when it comes to kind of reaching an answer to that question, I guess, obviously, there are lots of comparative themes that you draw out in the book, some broader, of course, literature on some of the disciplinary concerns of ethnomusicology, of anthropology, of migration and diaspora, and so on. So I wonder if you could say a bit more about what you concluded overall about what the Chaoshensu musical world had in common with, for example, other Chinese minority groups or with other Korean musical or cultural traditions inside or outside Korea, and what was different from those things. What did you sort of ultimately decide or conclude was distinctive in this way?
I mean, Chaoshensu music shares certainly some commonalities with other ethnic music in China. Not just minority music, but perhaps more with Han Chinese construction of national music. I mean, I would say that almost all minority music in China have been influenced by Han Chinese construction of national music. And some of the features that I can share were Han Chinese construction of national music emphasized instrumental reformation so that traditional ethnic instruments could have a louder sound to be played for larger audiences who come to appreciate music in larger concert halls, venues. And also, Chinese government emphasized the implementation of some of the foreign influences, if that is will make Chinese culture positive or more effective and progressive, right? So they implemented equally tempered tuning mechanism for traditional Chinese as well as ethnic instruments. And they want to have, large ensembles. And in order to create good sonority of the ensembles, then definitely instrumental reformation and equally tempered tuning system was necessary. So some of these characteristics and Han Chinese influences are obviously found in Chaoshensu music. But at the same time, as a minority music in China, Chaoshensu need to mark their own minority cultures. So Chaoshensu need to develop the musical instruments and musical repertoires that are distinctive to Chinese Koreans in China. So as I said at the beginning of migration and Korean migrant cultures in early 20th century, you don't find a lot of information about how traditional Korean instruments were performed in China. It was rather after 1949 when Chinese Korean musicians and intellectuals want to promote their minority identity by developing and transplanting some of the traditional instruments from Korea. So they were very conscious of using traditional Korean instrument, but at the same time, they want to create that and develop that having Chinese influence or Han Chinese influence. So reformation of traditional Korean instruments were obviously there. And then in order to perform this Korean traditional instrument, they wanted to create musical repertoire composed by many Chaoshensu musicians. And that can appeal to Chaozhenju audiences in China.
Well, I think that is an indication of some of the complexities of these sort of it's almost like a kind of nested or entangled set of influences and hierarchies and flows that I think you trace here, because exactly as you say, as a response, I guess, to a kind of Euro-American hegemonic framing for what performed music is like, there's a broader Chinese response as far as you say, reforms to certain musical instruments and also the composition of ensembles and the composition of music, musical pieces is concerned. That is happening in broader China as a response to perhaps this Euro-American hegemony of cultural form. But within China, then China, that Chinese and, as you say, Han Chinese dominated pattern comes to be hegemonic for Chinese minority groups. And so groups like Chaozhenju respond to that, right? They have that sort of quality of being nested within multiple layers of hegemonic form, but also with a sort of outlet to Korea, to a separate national, identification with certain kinds of musical styles. So I think that the interplay between those things is something you tease out extremely well, despite it being extremely, extremely complex.
Thank you. Yeah, it is very complex. I mean, there are tons of discussions, recorded exchange between musicians and intellectuals, how to make the music distinctive to Chaozhenju and fit into their cultural identity. What I found out is Chaozhenju musicians and intellectuals are always conscious about making things that is working for their own community. So they had these two big political and culture mandate and agenda that they need to make their music as Chinese minority and at the same time something that is distinctive about ethnic Koreans in China.
So I mean, lots of this obviously so far and plenty of your kind of contacts and conversations in the book too are focused on this more intellectual tradition, the kind of as you've said, construction, which I guess is a kind of twofold construction, both of ethnic identity at large, Chaozhenju as a category within China, but also then, as you've put it, the music that is identified with that group. So I wonder, I mean, during your fieldwork, you were in conversation with some of these leaders of some of the performance troupes that we might say a little bit more about shortly, as well as, people who've studied the musical tradition based in Yanbian. During that fieldwork, were there any particular sort of challenges that presented themselves with doing that work relating to the conscious construction of Chaozhenju music? And were you able to balance that with thinking about more spontaneous, more vernacular, everyday varieties of Chaozhenju music? How do you see the interplay there? And how did that play out in your actual fieldwork as you conducted it?
Okay, I'd like to share a little bit of my contemplation and experiences in the field in answering your question. Mm-hmm. This is something that I discussed in my chapter on an introductory chapter, and also something that I carried on a lot throughout the research journey of Chaozhenju music. What was extremely challenging for me is that a lot of musical creation and appreciation were centering the institutions, and those institutions were government-run institutions. So many musicians who I met were affiliated with government musical troupes, and also teaching and working at the minor Chaozhenju music schools called Yanbian issue yuan. So Yanbian music schools are a primary site that I was able to view what was going on with the Chaozhen music. And by accessing to their libraries, I was able to read many magazines and historical documents rarely accessible to outside of those institutions. So I had to contemplate a lot that, my research has been much focused on the institutional construction of Chaozhen music. And frankly speaking, in the middle of 2000, even if I try very hard, it was extremely hard for me to experience the music produced and performed as a private entertainment or private musical groups. So a lot of live music venues that I experienced was either with government musical troupes or what was happening in Yanbian minority music schools in Yanbian. So that was one of the contemplation that I have, am I sort of looking enough diversity of Chaozhen music, and am I studying enough diversity of Chaozhen music that are available in and outside of institutions. And also gaining access to even sound recordings were extremely difficult. I was lucky enough to have a friend who were working in a Yanbian broadcasting TV and radio broadcasting company. So I was able to access and listen to some of the sound recordings produced in Yanbian broadcast station. However, there was almost none instrumental music recorded in sound objects at the time. There are tons of vocal music available to buy and listen to. I was spending quite a bit of time, viewing local TV channels, which have, regular musical programs. And vocal music were always, dominating instrumental music. So there are these different sort of musical cultures that I need to combine together to gain a fuller picture of what was going on with music in Chaozhen community and Yanbian.
Well, yeah, and I think, notwithstanding those difficulties, those challenges with access, it's something that you've done a very good job of painting a pretty full picture. So I think I overcame some of those challenges extremely, extremely well. I guess out of curiosity, I wonder, do you have still a physical collection of, I don't know, tapes or CDs or anything that you picked up at the time of that kind of music?
Yeah, I collected many vocal music collections by visiting the major bookstore known as Xinhua Shudian in China. And also I was able to collect a number of CDs, VCDs, produced by the Jilin Radio Recording Company, which I visited and interviewed some of the people who are working there. So I do have those collections. But as I said, that the majority of collections that I was able to acquire were on vocal music collections. So not many instrumental music collections that I own, other than some of the recordings that I made by attending some live music performances. And I spent a lot of time making copies of personal manuscripts. Sometimes it was even handwritten composition manuscripts owned by composers who are working in Yanbian song and dance troupes or Yanji art troupes. So I spent quite a bit of time making Xeroxes and of this music that would never or hardly published for the view of public audiences or public, people who are interested in Chaozhenju music.
There's something very interesting there. I don't know. I mean, it's come out in your last couple of answers there, but there's almost something paradoxical about the fact that, you know, this is a mass culture. It's something that notionally is identified with a kind of universalizing project to make Chaozhenju identity and to have music as a key part of that. So, I mean, it's something I've also observed in not music itself, but other areas where it's actually very difficult sometimes to get access to actually find where the core of that is. Something that's quite jealously guarded by intellectuals or people who consider themselves responsible for that identity, despite the fact that in other ways that identity and elements of it claim to be universal and applying to all Chaozhenju people. I think that's a very interesting kind of paradoxical situation you've outlined there.
Yeah, and another challenge that I felt I had to rely on a lot of personal connections and acquaintances to get me to, access some of the personal collection of music or to interview some of the major musicians who were working in Yanbian. So, I was very grateful that I had enough connections so that I could complete my research. But at the same time, I feel bad that I constantly need to rely on someone else and asking for refer me to the person, who I can interview or who I can find information on Chaozhenju music. So mixture of feelings always, accompanying my whole journey of ethnographic research in Yanbian.
Sure. Well, I think that's a very recognizable anthropological kind of feeling too, that ultimately one's work is always based on the extreme generosity and goodwill of many, many people that without whom you would never be able to understand a lot of what you can hopefully come to understand through that work. So I appreciate that. We'll jump in a little deeper into some of the kind of content of the book in a second, but I just wondered, finally, I mean, on this question of construction of identity or related to this question of construction of identity and your own work on it, you use the term Chaozhenju throughout the book to refer to the group of Chinese Koreans. And I just wondered, what kind of the reason behind choosing that particular term, because you see some literature on this group who would say in English, Korean, Chinese, or use the Chosunjok Korean term for this group. So was there some particular decision behind using Chaozhenju as a label?
Right. Believe it or not, it was really, difficult for me to choose this term. And I was constantly back and forth between several different terms until I finalized my manuscript. So, choosing Chaozhenju was simple, that I wanted to use a terminology that was widely circulated in the context of geopolitical context in which the majority of my informants are living. There was a primary reason. I was thinking about why am I using Chaozhenju instead of Chosunjo? Because I don't want to distinguish them from the rest of ethnic minorities in China who would not be called with foreign terminologies. So I was thinking about, why Hanzu, why Huizu, why Mongutsu, these people are named as, you know, something that they used in the context of China. So that was the primary reason why I chose Chao Xingzhu. But then I know I spent quite a bit of time contemplating, should I just name them as a Koreans in China? But then, you know, as you know, there are other groups of Koreans who moved from South Korea or North Korea and living in China. So I don't want to sort of explain that all the time. And also Chinese Korean or Korean Chinese. That was a difficult choice as well, because, you know, if I call them as a Chinese Korean, then am I kind of putting Chinese forward and Korean behind, or vice versa? So there are a lot of complications that I need to juggle and think about before I finalize the term Chao Xingzhu. I'm still not confident and fully not sure that whether I made the best choice. And who knows, maybe next time I write about Chao Xingzhu music, I'll use a Joseon joke or Korean Chinese. But while I was completing my manuscript, I thought, okay, I'm going to go with the Chao Xingzhu. Because I want to, you know, name them as many other ethnic minorities in China were named. Yeah, that was a simple but yet difficult decision for me to make.
Well, yeah, and it makes sense. It reflects lots of the actual themes, not just the, you know, academic choices, but actual topic of the book too. So I think that helps us to understand something broader about the experience. But I wonder, yeah, if we could get into, I mean, the sort of mid part of the book deals with some of the topics that we've already alluded to so far, the construction of Chao Xingzhu musical identity, use of certain instruments. And as you say, there were challenges in accessing instrumental music and instrument-based musical practice rather than vocal. So it'd be interesting to hear more about that. And then also you've mentioned some of the troops, some of these larger organizations or collectives that actually performed and were in turn responsible for constructing the sense of what Chao Xingzhu music was. So I wonder, could you say a bit more about the construction of Chao Xingzhu music as an intellectual and political project in the socialist years in China, in particular, you know, post 1949, as you mentioned, is a kind of key era for the development of the idea of Chao Xingzhu music, in turn, yeah, why certain instruments, you mentioned the kayagum, were kind of part of that construction, and then how it was performed. That's a lot to deal with, but maybe if you just give us more of a sense of those kind of the detail, who was involved and what kind of choices were made by intellectuals, and how the music turned out.
Yep. Well, as I alluded previously, I mean, Joseonju instrumental music was not so prevalent before 1949. In fact, the musical landscape of Chao Xingzhu in pre-1949 was rather a mixture of Western classical music, band music, and lots of popular music. And if there were traditional Korean music, majority of the music were vocal folk songs and some musical instrument that represented farmers' identity. So as I mentioned, some of the farmers' band music and flute, which were used by Chinese, Korean, or Chao Xingzhu, were there. Yet some of the professionalized, you know, instrumental music were not so prevalent before 1949. And majority of the musicians who was hired, who were hired as the musicians who specialize in Korean music and who were recruited as the people developing Korean music in China were actually trained in Western classical music traditions or Western band music. So exposure to Korean traditional instruments for these Joseon musicians were quite limited at the beginning of 1950s. However, some of the musicians were able to find Gayageum in actually Hunchun and Yenji, and they were fascinated by these the fact that there were some Korean musical instruments available in Yenbin. So without having a deep knowledge how to perform this instrument, they start to experimenting that instrument, and having background in Western classical music string instrument, people were able to manage to play very simple tunes out of this instrument.
Yeah, so we should just, I wonder if we can just add quickly, sorry to interrupt, but the Gayageum, can you just mention briefly what it is, what kind of an instrument it is?
Right. Gayageum is a 12-string Korean zither. I would say it is one of the emblematic instruments representing Joseonju community, as well as South Korea and North Korea. It is having 12 strings, but these days Gayageum has been made to have 18 strings, 21 strings, 23 strings, 25 strings. So depending on the cultural context, you will see different numbered Gayageum. It is similar to Chinese guzheng, the Chinese 21-string string instrument, and in fact, Gayageum was known that created in Korea, inspired by Chinese zither instrument. So, Gayageum was found in Hunchun and Yenji by coincidence, and that was the reason that some of the Joseonju intellectuals and musicians start to promote this instrument as the major instrument of Joseonju ensemble. So lacking professional musicians on this instrument, actually Joseonju government sent some musicians to North Korea, and then those are Joseonju instruments. Musicians were learned to play this instrument after spending some time in North Korea, and came back to Yenbin and became the teacher of this instrument.
That makes sense. Yeah, well, that again, it shows a kind of immediate, connection or sort of hybridity or entanglement of different influences on that on the prominence of that instrument itself. So, I mean, once that kind of early process of the formation of musical identity had sort of got underway, what were the kind of groups that were then organized to perform it, and what was the role of these ensembles, these kind of Yishu-tuan or Yishu kind of right. The artistic troops and stuff. What was their kind of role in disseminating the music?
One of the major troops who were responsible for Joseonju music construction and performance in China was Yenbin Songyan Dance Troupe, right? So Yenbin Songyan Dance Troupe was in Yenbin for a long period of time, even before they started developing Korean ensemble as a part of the troupe. Many song and dance musicians were trained in Western classical music, but then when Joseonju government start emphasizing that we need to create Joseonju music distinctive to Joseonju in China, then there was a time that Yenbin Song and Dance Troupe started focusing on developing and performing Korean ensembles. So definitely Yenbin Song and Dance Troupe was the primary and major troupe that was promoting and presenting Korean music in Yanbian. And in fact, as the government cultural agenda shifted from various times throughout the second half of 20th century, at one point, Yanbian song and dance troupe got rid of all of Western classical music instruments and only focused on Korean instruments. But other times, when political sort of climate has shifted to more revolutionary emphasis in China, then they try not to perform so much music that are distinctive about their cultural identity, yet rather perform the nationally promoted revolutionary songs and music by use of Western classical instruments. So Yanbian Song and Dance Troupe was a major player of Joseon music, but at the same time, the troupe itself went through quite a bit of a shift responding to the shift of government cultural policy. One of the contrasting troupe is Yanbian Yanji art troupe, which was representing Yanji city. And this troupe was actually emerged in early 1980s when Yanji government wants to re-celebrate minority identity in post-cultural revolutionary China. So Yanji art troupe deliberately promoted Korean instruments and always highlighted Korean traditional cultural elements by way of a musical instrument and repertoires. So you can see distinctive sort of promotion of different identities between Yanbian Song and Dance Troupe and Yanji Art Troupe. Yanbian Song and Dance Troupe was more conscious about embracing diverse demographics in Yanbian, whereas Yanji Art Troupe promotes more Joseon identity and want to be distinctive cultural group that focuses on Joseon instrument and folk musical repertoires.
Well, those kind of institutions are an especially fascinating, I think, kind of lens through which to look at some of these changes which you chart across time over the decades, you know, running from back in the early 50s all the way through the Mao period and the Cultural Revolution and so on, and then into more recent times, you know, with all of the shifts that entailed, with emphasis on ethnic distinctiveness or Chinese unity, you know, and or kind of somewhat Han-dominated Chinese unity, perhaps, and then in turn, how that also interacted with relations with North Korea and the openness to the outside world, including across just across the Tumen River, you know, to North Korea, and how openness or closeness influenced the kinds of things that were being played and the kinds of instruments and compositions that were part of that. So that's a, you know, a really immensely interesting, I think, index of some of the changes that have swept around Yanbian over time, and would encourage listeners to become readers and really check that out in a lot more detail in the book. But I wonder, as we kind of move towards the end, could you say some more about how these troupes, which you visited and did work with, they, you know, still exist after all these decades. The back of the book even has a picture of the of one of them on it, the building that one of them is in, which I have to say, you know, at the time looks slightly looks like it's kind of in a back street and maybe not the most prominent location. But in any case, how have these kind of more institutional, organized forms of Joseon music fared in the kind of market era, I guess, since the 1980s and since consumption of music has changed so much with both technology and, of course, with the broader socio-political changes involved in, you know, buying and selling different forms of music?
I mean, still at official level, these music troupes are functioning, and they're the representative of music troupes of Yanji City as well as Yanbian as a Korean autonomous prefecture. However, even in the middle of 2000, already the music troops were having difficulty because the type of government subsidies that the musicians receive as the member of those troops were not coping up with inflations that Yanbian people were singing at the time. So they were losing some members who are leaving the Yanbian for South Korea or bigger cities in China to find jobs other than music professions. So already like in the middle of the 2000s, these musicians were these musical troops were confronting some difficulties how to survive through the influx of market economy that are coming to Yanji and Yanbian. However, if they want to be professional musicians in Yanbian, then you know, obviously, the Yanbian song and dance troupe and Yanji art troupe are the distinctive troops that will grant them some kind of you know, cultural capitals and social capitals. So, I mean, not financial or economic sense of capitals, but you know, because of other reasons, number of musicians decide to stay and remain as the members of song and dance troupe and Yanji's arts troupe. However, they had to find other ways to bring some more, you know, financial stability to their in order to sustain in musicians or art professionals in Yanbian. So they were performing for you know, someone's sort of private parties and also taking jobs that that they accompanied some vocal singers who are recording their music. So and also teaching private students. So they were taking multiple sort of jobs that so that they can combine together and sustain as you know, art professionals in Yanbian. And obviously I can imagine that, you know, that kind of sort of marginalization of this institution of music has been even intensified when the majority of audiences are quite attracted to global music as well as you know, South Korean music arriving in Yanbian since the early 2000s, and perhaps the degree of you know, sort of distribution and consumption of global pop music will be even more today. So, yeah.
Well, I wonder, I mean, that kind of brings us full circle, really, to where we started with your initial encounter with the question of Chaoshensu music in South Korea. So maybe I'll ask just one final question, kind of drawing on from that, because you mentioned their kind of K-pop and the kind of musical influences that are there in Yanbian today. Certainly that is everywhere, just as it is elsewhere in the world, of course. But I wonder then what happens when a certain essentialized version or a constructed institutional version of Chaoshensu Korean in China music meets something like K-pop or meets a kind of broader South Korean musical environment where, of course, certain forms of music are equally identified with Koreanness. I mean, the K thing, K dramas, K culture, K-pop is also identified with a sort of, I don't know, almost ethno-national kind of label, if you like. So what has happened in more recent times with meetings between Chaoshensu musicians and people who know about Chaoshensu music and South Korean, again, actors in their musical space?
I think there are definitely generation differences who are consuming and more geared toward the South Korean music or global pop music or even like Chinese pop music as young consumers. But at the same time, there are mid-age or older Chaozenju audiences who want to continue to consume some of the locally produced the music that sort of appealing to the sense of Chaozenju-ness. So when I was researching some of the vocal music sung by Chaozenju musicians recently, that some of the commentaries that I was able to read were they really appreciate, you know, this type of Chaozenju music that, you know, reminds of their, you know, younger years or reminds of something that their, you know, parents or grandparents were listening to. Mm. But obviously there are, you know, the sort of diverse reactions and consumption patterns that you can read in the consumption of some you know, popular and vocal music in Yanbian. Speaking about the instrumental music, I mean, a lot of Chaozenju musicians, in fact, visited South Korea with a curiosity to learn what was the sort of a traditional Korean music practiced in South Korea, beginning from the mid-1990s and throughout, you know, today. And often they want to sort of enhance their traditional aspect of performing Korean music when they visited South Korea. But when they came back to Yanbian, they said that, you know, we'll have to reshape our music out of what we experienced and what we learned in South Korea, also combining that with our experiences and training as musicians, Chaozenju musicians in Yanbian. So constantly, I can read that these musicians are conscious about who they are and what kind of a music they want to create, and they want to share with their audiences who are based in Yanbian. Another thing that I noticed is that, you know, they collaborate a lot with the South Korean musicians when they visited South Korea. But oftentimes, sometimes their Chaozenju identity was not highlighted. Instead, they were invited and collaborating in order to reproduce and represent sound of North Korea. So there were kind of bit of sort of misunderstanding and overlooking of Chaozenju musical identity and you know, distinctive cultural construction that these people had as a Korean minority in China. So in chapter 7, I kind of wanted to share that my observation of this hierarchical nationhood that I experienced in South Korea, that, you know, there are quite unequal treatment of Korean ethnicities based upon and according to what South Koreans want to see and what South Koreans want to, you know, understand the cultural identity of Chaozenju. So things are never got simpler, but more complex and complicated. That as South Korea encountered a lot of North Korean refugees coming down to South Korea, and depending on the what point of political time period that South Korea wanted to have a more North Korean culture and you know and sort of celebrating the sort of better relationship or hoping the better relationship between North and South Korea, then the sort of contributor to this kind of, you know, musical landscape was Charles and Drew. Oftentimes, their distinctiveness as a culture agency was not hardly, there and earn as much credit as, other sort of musical agency in South Korea. So I was a little bit sad to, observe those kind of scenes happening and emerging in South Korea in early 2010s.
Mm. Well, I think that definitely reproduces or reflects observations that many people have made about the situation, especially the Joseon-jok, Chao Shin-soo position within South Korea, where I guess under this banner of Katun Minjok, right? This idea of same being from the same nationality, from the same family, being Koreans, Chao Shin-soo is sometimes viewed as a kind of bridge to North Korea and as part of a North-South dynamic without really attributing enough separateness or distinctiveness, I should say, to that Chao Shin-soo identity. So I think throughout this whole book and indeed during this interview, you've done a great job of excavating and asserting some of this really special and fascinating and distinctive Chao Shin-soo experience. So thanks very much, Sunny, for doing that for us today. Before we wrap up fully, though, I'll ask you our final traditional question on the New Books Network, which is what you're working on at the moment, what kind of projects have developed out of your work on Chao Shin-soo music, and what have you up to currently?
Well, after my research, field research in Yanbian and on Chao Shin-soo, I also got into research of North Korean migrant troops in South Korea and also North Korean troops in Japan. Currently, I am working on my second book manuscript project I hope to illustrate how the plurality and diversification of Korean ethnicity manifested in different construction of national music poses a question: what the Korean national music and what Korean identity is. I also want to bring attention to how this national culture is dialectically created between nation based in Korea and with transnational influences. So my interest in migrant studies and migrants as a culture creator continues, but this time I want to look at more diversified groups and want to look at how this national culture that we believe something represents the Korea can be also transnationally transformed and shaped.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like an amazingly interesting expansion of some of the themes here, as well as exploration of quite new areas. So we'll look forward very much to reading that book too when it appears. In the meantime, thanks very much, Sunny, for appearing on the podcast today. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ed. Thanks for inviting me.
Listeners, thank you too for listening in as ever. Please do check out this excellent book, and we'll see you next time on New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. Goodbye.